And our guest tonight is Dr. John Alexander, Colonel Alexander as well. He is a leading advocate for the development of non-lethal weapons. We're going to talk with him about that. We're going to talk with him about a guest who was on last week who had his own revelations about some issues. And then we'll talk about remote viewing right here on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. John Alexander is a leading advocate for the development of non-lethal weapons. And during his varied career, he held many key positions in special operations, intelligence, as well as research and development. During the 1960s, he commanded Special Forces A teams in Vietnam and Thailand. Dr. Alexander organized and chaired the five major conferences on non-lethal weapons, served as a U.S. delegate to four NATO studies on conferences on non-lethal weapons, and also was a member of the first Council on Foreign Relations study that led to the creation of the Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Directorate. Currently, he is the Executive Vice President of LEADS, Inc., and serves as a consultant to U.S. Special Operations Command. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Colonel, welcome back. How are you?
George, good to talk to you again.
You too, John. Since we last talked on an official basis for a full program, I think it was June of 2004. Lots,
like an antiquity, yeah.
Lots have changed since then. Did you think we'd still be in Iraq, a year and a half ago?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, I think we have a strategic blunder there, and it's a tar baby because you can't get in and you can't get out.
No, you can't.
No simple solutions.
What would happen, because I've always wanted to ask someone in the know if they could predict for us, if every U.S. troop left Iraq, came back home, what would happen to those Iraqis who are there now, governing, who are, you know, working on pushing their constitution? What would happen to them? Would they get slaughtered?
Well, the question is much broader than that. And in fact, in winning the war, I addressed this because my notion is that the next world war has begun and that this is only a piece of it. The war is religious, and that's unfortunate. But I think you see it devolve into a civil war, which many of us predicted a long time ago. And we have just created a situation with no easy solutions and no rights and wrongs. We're living, by the way, with I like to blame the Europeans, but you remember, they are the ones who drew the maps at the end of the Ottoman Empire, and they did not do so based on the people who lived in these areas. And if you want, we can go into, because I think there are two models of war that are ongoing. We're fighting one, and the other side is fighting jihad, which is totally different.
No, you're right.
Guys just don't understand it yet or won't acknowledge it.
Now the Pentagon says that our troops will stay there for 2 years. I really don't think they have a plan, do they?
No, they're winging it and have been almost from the start. And we saw that, from the beginning when they started saying we have reason A for going in. Oops, that didn't work. We'll try reason B, and reason B didn't work. And so now we stay to reason C. And I really think they are winging it. I have read the promulgating documents on the war on terror, and they are so politically correct that and nobody will stand up and just say this is wrong. This doesn't happen.
You're absolutely right. And the one main thing that we have now is we've encircled those oil fields, and I don't think, John, we're going to give them up.
Well, in my view, the only way we can get out of the mess that we're in the long term is to totally change the energy paradigm. We have just got to get off of petrochemicals. And we know how to do that. And what I don't think we're doing is putting enough money into high-risk, high-payoff ventures, like zero-point energy and things of that nature. But if we stay, if we stay tied to petrochemicals with the competing factions that are rising in China with their energy consumption, the future does not look real rosy.
No, I agree. Yesterday I was driving and came right up on a hybrid car, one of these part electric, part gasoline cars. And I said, how novel. They can just make the push now and go the full distance in you know, whether it's hydrogen fuel or all electric, whatever it is, as long as it's not oil, what a major difference things would be.
Well, it's huge. What's interesting, though, if you go to buy a hybrid, you got to get in line. And that's one of the big drawbacks. There just aren't enough of them available. People who want them, they say, okay, in 6 months we'll deliver the car. As you know, most people, when they buy a car, they go out and they want to drive away with the car.
Yeah, well, that's true. Let's get back to Iraq in a moment. Last week we had a guest on the program, John Ronson, who talked about some of the things that went on with the military a long time ago. And I want to get your reaction to that because you know, overlap some of those areas.
Oh, I'm a principal in the book. And my word for this, I have two words. It's called Jason Blair. And I'm assuming that any journalist is familiar with that.
Well, that's a polite way of putting it, isn't it?
Well, for the audience who's not, Jason Blair was a New York Times reporter who caused them considerable damage because he was faking stories.
Ended up having to resign.
Right.
And out he went in a scandal.
And the problem that we have is, A, most of this stuff was wrong. B, starting counting today, I have now located 16 of the people in the book. 13 of us have, to the best of our knowledge, never met this guy.
And well, it sounds like you guys were his best friend.
Well, I know, and I mean, there are some glaring errors that are mentioned, like in the Playboy article as well as the book. Like Al Gore is one of, I'm one of Al Gore's best friends, for instance. I've met him once. He wouldn't know me if I walked in the door or anything else. But the whole book is just replete with those. And what happened was that there was an individual whom he gives some credit, John Sargent, with whom a number of us did meet. Some of them didn't even meet him. And yet he has all these firsthand references as if they're real. And the biggest problem that I have, that's a huge one, of course, is a word that I got published called ergofusion. And ergofusion means the misidentification of causal relationships. You know, if this, then that.
Right.
And his book says, because of some stuff we did, and there were some things we did, we can talk about some of the kind of far-out stuff we did.
Sure.
Early 80s. But therefore, Abu Ghraib happened. In the book, because they did remote viewing, Heaven's Gate happened. And yet there's no earthly connection between those things.
Well, when I read his book, and then we had him on the air, and he talked about the military trying to get people to walk through walls, I went, would they really do that? But it sounded pretty convincing.
Well, it's really what happens is he's taken sort of a little bit of truth and extrapolated tremendously. And the basic answer is no. The guy he talks about, General Stubblebine, is a friend of mine. We're still in contact. By the way, he says that he has not met John, although that has come up several times.
Okay.
And I can tell you definitely, I mean, he was my boss. He was Major General. At that time, I was a Lieutenant Colonel before I got promoted. And he definitely knew the difference between a hypothetical construct, i.e., atoms are mostly made up of space, so therefore you ought to be able to interpenetrate
right
in reality. And yet this book and the articles are written like he stood around in his office and kept running into the wall and threatening to break his nose.
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, that's what the guest, John Ronson, was saying, that he's kept smashing into the wall.
It's silliness. Absolute, and that's an example. Now, the 1st Earth Battalion comes up in this, and interestingly, another person who, like my, by the way, in the book, he actually describes my house and whatnot, does the same with Jim Channon. And Jim created the 1st Earth Battalion. By the way, I'd urge that you get him on because he can tell you some fantastic stories.
Okay, we'll do that.
And Jim is one of the most brilliant creative imagineers that was in the Army. And they did send him out kind of on a scouting mission looking at a lot of unusual technology. We're looking to say, CR, what we were interested in is how do you take good people and make them better? We have a lot of modalities in, you know, therapies that how do you take broken people and try to fix them? We wanted to push the other end, side of the envelope. Jimmy is a gifted artist. And what you could do with him is say, I've got an idea, and like we're doing now, discussing something, and he walks up to the board and draws these tremendous pictures so that people can look at it and graphically see these notions. And certainly some of the things that he did you still see in Army graphics today, some of the basic symbol. 99% of this stuff was very straight forward. And so the thing about the carrying the goats is like one technology out of 125 different ideas that were put forth in the 1st Earth Battalion. I would like to talk about the battalion per se because
Why don't you explain what the 1st Earth Battalion was?
Yes, and contrary to what is written, in reality, it was a notional kind of unit. It is not real, okay? Although, if you read the book, it actually says that I was offered command of this unit. It never was a military unit. Just doesn't exist, whatever. It was, as I say, notional. In the early 80s, there was something called Task Force Delta, which is not to be confused with Delta Force. And it was a think tank, and we looked at a lot of very, very far-out stuff. And it was a freedom to think. Now, being a military unit, the idea of having an element or something that you could put these notional constructs on was very useful. So he created and actually owns, literally copyrighted, the 1st Earth Battalion. And there is, if you go to his website, which is jimchannon.com, you can actually download the training manual. And it was trying to revisit, you know, what war might look like in the future and how some of these, what were then emerging technologies, particularly in making people better, how that would affect both the military and the world.
Well, this 1st Earth Battalion and some of the things that Ronson speculated that they've done, I mean, when you say part of it was true, part of it was not, I mean, how much is fabrication in terms of his story?
Well, almost all.
In terms of percent? Oh, okay.
Almost all. But the 1st Earth Battalion, like I said, was a private thing owned by Channon, and it's a book, and people can go in and look at it. It never was a real unit. They even got the goat thing wrong. So even when I had first heard, there was a book that came out in the UK first.
And just so people know what we're talking about, Ronson claims that the organization had people who concentrated on killing goats.
Yeah,
it was a test
right.
to see if they could then try it on humans with their mind.
Yeah.
Not with a weapon, but with their mind,
yeah.
right?
When the book first came out in the UK, which is slightly different from the US version, I did send him an email and said, you got it wrong. He hit the goat because I am the person who put him in touch with an individual by the name of Guy Savelli, a martial artist. And this had come about in an interview with John Sargent. See, a number of us were interviewed by a third party, not by Ronson.
But for the book?
Had no knowledge of a book or anything.
He was doing
some video stuff, and they came to see me ostensibly to talk about non-lethal weapons. And John Sargent, in fact, it was so bad, I called Simon and Schuster and said, are John Sargent and John Ronson the same person? And they assured me that it was not. Now, I do happen to think, by the way, that there is another story here for your public, which says the disdain with which the print media holds them, because I pointed out, as we mentioned earlier, the Jason Blair problem, that most of this is fabricated, and
sure.
they basically said, we don't care. So did anybody do any fact-checking? And said, yeah, we checked the facts. Well, they went back to the author and said, but And the same with Playboy. I said, a number of us are in there. It sounds pretty far out. We're not hidden. I mean, you know, Channon and I and Sobelbein are pretty easy
here.
To find.
That's right.
You know, wouldn't you, if it gets, you got something that's really wild, wouldn't you go and ask some of the principals, you know, did this happen? And they've chosen not to.
I remember years ago as a Cub reporter, one of these wild newspapers that you see at the supermarket had some bizarre story, and they quoted some guy. And I'm saying, this has got to be one of the greatest stories in the world. You know, it was like some alien landed on his lap or something like that. So the guy was real. I called him up, and I read him the quotes that were in this supermarket tabloid, and he denied it all. He said, that didn't happen. And he said, there was no alien. That was, you know, it was this, this, and this. And the newspaper apparently took the whole thing out of context and, you know, took a real guy and just changed the whole story completely.
Sure. And I think what should be disconcerting to your listening public is that the publishers flat don't care. You know, they're either complicit and or don't care. I mean, I think that says something about, you know, what how they view the American public.
Well, and they labeled this one as nonfiction, right?
Yeah.
So if they had, you know, splattered fiction all over it, they might have been able to get away with some of this. You know, you take some real episodes and some not so real and make and write your book.
Well, the piece that makes it interesting in the book, and I've talked to a number of people who have unfortunately read it, they say what they like are these personal anecdotes. I said, he said, and didn't happen.
So you think the whole thing was created?
Well, there are bits of it that are, I mean, I did find three people, and they are three of the ones who were in the Playboy article who did meet with him. Getting back to Guy Civelli before we get out, my note to him was, by the way, he hit the goat. And I was interested. I had seen some photos and talked to some folks involved in the experiment, and this was something called Dim Mac, which is, in and of itself is quite interesting. That's known in martial arts community as the death touch. And this was the first physical evidence that I had seen indicating that that was, in fact, real.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that is a martial arts technique where they could, you know, present non-physical force. It was done through energy. And they could hurt you.
In this case, they actually hit the goat, and the goat remained hobbled and then died at some point later. They had kept the goat in front of a TV camera. And Civelli did do some very unusual things, and I trained with him for a while and came away impressed. But the notion that we have a group of guys at Fort Bragg sitting around staring at goats is just ludicrous.
Well, it was important to get you on to talk about that and some other things, John, as well. And when we come back, let us talk about what's going on now with the current future warfare. I understand we've got this sound machine out there in Iraq now that can bring people down to their knees. The Israelis have it as well. Whose technology is it, and what else is out there that we might not even be aware of? I'm George Norrie. Our guest tonight, Colonel John Alexander, high technology. What about people who claim that their neighbors are beaming microwaves right at them? What's that all about? We'll be right back. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Dr. John Alexander, our guest. John, what's out there new on the horizon that the public, all of us, that we just don't know about technology-wise?
Oh, technology-wise. I mean, the world is moving so fast these days. You, as we were closing, mentioned a few things that have certainly come on the horizon that have been in research and development for a number of years, and acoustic weaponry and things like that that are getting accelerated because of some real needs. I did see recently there was a system called the ADS, or the Area Denial System, a millimeter wave beam that can reach out for, you know, quite a distance, and it hits the skin, hits the pain receptors, causes a lot of pain, but I see that they've been able to miniaturize it and get a unit. I don't know if it's gone to Iraq yet or if it's about to go, But again, that's something I've been working on for a long time, and finally decided that we really need some different kinds of weapons. We got the killing stuff down pretty well. We know how to do that. But it's not terribly useful in the kinds of engagements that we find ourselves now.
Things have changed. I mean, the war technology has changed, and the whole makeup has changed. I mean, you're right. I mean, in the old days, everybody had uniforms. That's not the case anymore.
Well, see, I've argued in Iraq, since that's the most current one, and Afghanistan. I think, you know, I was in Afghanistan for a while, about a year and a half ago. And the problem is that we're fighting one set of wars that's geographically based. And, you know, all the reports come out about the foreign fighters who have, come to join the fight. And in reality, they're fighting a philosophical-based war, as you
right.
mentioned earlier, jihad. And that's just them moving to wherever the fight is. And I think we're kind of hypocritical here because back in, remember, early Afghanistan, the early rounds, when they were fighting the then Soviet Union, we thought jihad was a good thing. You know, bin Laden and company over there out of Pakistan fighting in Afghanistan to get the nasty Soviets out, that was good. Now that they're doing the same thing to us, it's bad.
And they're the same group of people.
Oh, some of them, and when you go into Afghanistan, are literally the same people. I mean,
this is the group called the Mujahideen, right? Basically,
well,
isn't that
not,
who it used
Mujahideen
to be?
Mujahideen is a very broad category, but yes,
right.
that's what they are. They categorize themselves as the holy warriors.
I remember an old James Bond movie, and I can't remember if it was Timothy Dalton or Roger Moore who starred in it, but they were in Afghanistan, or they were out there in the Middle East somewhere, and the Mujahideen befriended him. They took care of James Bond, and they helped him get out of the situation he was in.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, John. If you equate that group at that time that we portrayed as heroes, it's Al-Qaeda people.
Yes, the same people.
Yeah. How changed.
Well, what goes around comes around.
Yeah, it's remarkable at how things like that will occur. But the bottom line here, though, is technology must change in order to keep abreast of this situation. You can't just keep fighting and more of them just keep coming, because these people are prepared to die that way, aren't they?
Oh, yes. And that's why we have found the effectiveness of the suicide bomber. The weapon system is cheap. It's a single person who has agreed to do the mission. They get a car. If they want to be really cheap, they can steal a car, pack it full of explosives.
Or wrap it to his backpack.
Yeah. And then just, go to the location. You talk about precision, you have, in general, the epitome of precision.
It's as precise as a laser-guided missile.
Oh, probably not. And there are areas we can get with laser-guided missiles. You know, you can fly through a window, and you could probably deliver more energy. But again, you're talking hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars a pop. You know, one cruise missile is about $500,000. Versus a system that costs very little, selects its target very precisely, wreaks terror, and has a tremendous psychological effect.
I am honestly, John, quite amazed, thank God. I think we're overdue that we haven't had a problem in this country, really, since 9/11, aren't you?
Well, I think it's when.
Yes.
Not if.
Here's the question, though. Why is it taking so long?
Well, that's an American question. And, our timelines tend to be, we like things that are short and simple.
And immediate.
Yeah. And we think that, if you hit me today, I got to hit you tomorrow and whatnot. Quite frankly, they're on different timelines. If you look at World Trade Center, that was 7 years between strikes. They're willing to take the time. And I think one of our vulnerabilities is exactly what you've mentioned. This well, it didn't happen. You know, the terrorists didn't strike, so therefore maybe there's no terrorists. No, that just means the terrorists didn't strike yet. And they are prepared to wait, and they are prepared to, wait until they get it right and have the right things in place, and we lower the guard. And their sense of time is just very different from us.
Does that then mean that some people like Paul Williams, who writes that there are nukes in America or will be, that they're accurate? Is this a problem?
It's very hard to say. There's certainly concern about nuclear material that's loose. Having said that, nukes are doing it the hard way. It's very difficult to move. It is easy to detect, as opposed to chemical or biological weapons that are, it's much easier to use and get, you know, the same kinds of results. The whole dirty bomb thing is really way, way overblown in my view, and I know some of the experts in the field, and it's different from what you read. I mean, a cute phrase saying is that a day without radiation is a day without sunshine. And we have literally, you know, got to where we're so afraid of radiation without understanding what that means. So it's not nearly the problem that it might be. And again, easy approach is chemical or biological weapons.
Well, they have said that they want to hit a number of cities consecutively in the United States. Is that all rhetoric, or do you think that they're going to be able to back that up?
Well, it's hard to say. What we, you know, the change that took place in Dar es Salaam is when we saw two attacks in very short order, because that requires a level of sophistication and coordination that we haven't seen. That is not my concern as much as there's a whole notion called superorganisms, and those are simple things that get together, and when they operate, they operate much more effectively, synergistically, if you will, than the simple parts. And I think what the Bin Laden and company did is train a whole bunch of people and just send them out with some pretty simplistic rules. You know, go forth and do bad things. And it's that ability to operate independently that is much more difficult for us to counter than a highly centralized organization. When we're used to fighting folks that have hierarchical communications and centralized leadership, and you can root those sorts of things out and do something about it. This notion that you got a bunch of guys out there who know how to do evil deeds, and they can pick and choose their own target and timing, that, frankly, I think is much more difficult to counter.
We had a story a few months ago that there's a possibility that a rogue nation will try to detonate a nuclear device, not on our ground, but up in the atmosphere, and then let it take out communications. Is that a real possibility, John?
Well, there's something called conjugate point, and this was something back in the days of the Cold War that was looked at. The electromagnetic pulse could take out communication. Well, hell, look at what happened today.
In Los Angeles.
Yeah. With a couple of guys just putting the wires together wrong, and that was purely accidental. So clearly we have not, you know, fully understood this critical infrastructure yet. So there are certain vulnerabilities. But to that, I would say, well, to what end? Okay, you cripple the electrical grid. That would be temporary at best. Yeah, you'd burn out some soft equipment. But as far as, you know, taking down the nation or something like that, no, that's just not going to happen.
Would it prevent launches of our missiles, for example?
No. Those systems are totally hardened and very well protected and run independently with independent power systems and that. And I don't see that as that's part of the critical infrastructure that is well protected. What's at risk with all of the electromagnetic pulse stuff is our civilian infrastructure, banks, telecommunications, finance, transportation systems. As you saw today, if you were watching television, the problem in Los Angeles was, you know, traffic lights were out. So,
and it's bad with traffic lights.
That's right. It's bad with it, but, you know, and so thinking out lots of traffic lights really raises tremendous havoc. And those are the kinds of things, you know, radio stations going off the air, popping, you know, maybe taking out some satellites. Yeah, you can do that.
I had to call my network to make sure we. I had to call my network today to make sure we were okay because we broadcast out of Los Angeles. Of course, we have redundancies and abilities to do it, but still, you never know what's going to happen.
But you're pointing to exactly what has happened throughout, you know, most of these key industries is they have recognized the vulnerabilities and we have built in redundancy, far from perfect. And that's why I asked the question: to what end? Somebody pops a nuke to be a nuisance. I mean, you know, the retaliation for that would be devastating. We absolutely would not tolerate that. You know, they would be, whoever it was, if identified, would be in the Stone Age. So, you know, just doesn't make sense to make, you know, to do an attack like that.
Is this a real serious concern? And if it is there a bigger group behind this, John, rather than just these people that we've been talking about over the last several years?
Are you're talking about what's going on? Well,
worldwide. I mean, to me, there's got to be some kind of organization.
Well, what I put in winning the war, no, I think it's actually broader than that. And much more difficult to counter. As I said, in winning the war, I believe the next world war is on. It has started. It is religious. And that does not mean that there aren't moderate Muslims. There are. And, you know, some are personal friends. Having said that, I think the two critical issues are the population growth rate in the Islamic world, coupled with a near lack of secular education in many areas. And if you go in and you look at what happened, remember the Saudis have been playing games with the Wahhabis for a long time. The House of Saud is corrupt and, you know, has a lot of internal problems. So what they did was to placate the Wahhabis, this ultra-conservative sect internally, they kind of left them alone and they developed the mudras or the schools. So what has happened is that the teachers that are now available in the Islamic schools primarily come from the Wahhabi sect, the ultra-conservatives. So as I said, you got this tremendous population growth rate with an educational system that's non-secular and very fundamentalist, and I think that's a deadly mixture.
All right, you might have some people in this country listening to you right now who are ultra-conservative as well, and they're saying, Colonel, what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with you? And I don't like that.
They've gone too far, I guess.
The problem is, in you know, when it converts, and you will find text out there that say that they anticipate seeing an Islamic world by 2020. That's probably pretty quick.
You think that's true?
I don't think it'll happen that fast. I do think there are people with such a blueprint. I think that one of the what you find in Europe is that, you know, remember the European nations were very reluctant to get into many of these battles. And part of the problem is you have a huge immigration problem. And they anticipate that in France, for instance, 20 to 25% of the population pretty soon, you have already maybe 6 million Muslims inside France. Germany has a huge population and growing. Last November, you remember the assassination of the filmmaker that took place in the Netherlands?
Yes.
And they're very forgiving. a very open, free society, and they were suddenly saying, oops, you know, what kind of a problem do we have here? I was called to testify before the Bundeswehr last November on non-lethal weapons, but taken aside, and the question was basically, what do we do? You know, we want to be a free democratic society, but we have this problem growing, and in pure numbers, it's a significant problem in Europe, and it's enough that you see them at odds with the international policy, and it's because of the number of Islamic immigrants that they have already, you know, in their area, is sufficient to cause serious problems. Look at Great Britain, the last bombing. Point there is those folks all were UK citizens. These were not, you know, foreign terrorists who came in from outside to attack Britain.
Exactly. You know, I've been watching on a regular basis the fighting in Iraq, for example, and you look at the insurgents. Where in the heck, John, are they getting their weapons? Where are they getting their machine guns? Where are they getting their shoulder missiles? Where are they getting this stuff?
Well, there's, of course, a huge amount was already there, and a lot of it just went underground. I still argue we're fighting Saddam's war. I think he was surprised in two areas. I don't think he expected to lose the war as fast, and that the Republican Guard would collapse as fast as it did, and I don't think he expected to be captured. But other than that, I think they did expect to go into a civil war that they, you know, buried and hid a huge amount. I mean, he had a phenomenal arsenal already there. Plus, you have porous boundaries just based on the size, the extent of the boundaries between both Syria and Iran. And it's clear there's a lot of stuff moving back and forth over those borders.
Have we made one of those ultimatums to those two countries?
Well, we've certainly made noises. And I think one of the big concerns, is, you know, what happens if you take on either Syria or Iran? And I think politically that becomes, you know, very difficult and probably unacceptable. And if you take the military strain now, add another country.
Let's talk about that when we come back, John, and then we'll get into remote viewing as well. Hey, John Alexander, we're going to talk more about non-lethal weapons. You know, you just a variety of information, John. You cover it all.
Well, you tend to be eclectic, so.
All right, Syria, Iran, what about both? Do we do it alone? Do we do it at all? Do we get the help of other countries?
I don't think you do it at all. I think we've got to we've got to strategically reposition ourselves. And what we don't have in the Middle East is a master plan. And I don't think we're prepared to go it alone. I don't think we have the forces to do that unless you're absolutely forced into such a war. Having said that, I do think the situation in Iran is quite dangerous if they continue, you know, developing nuclear weapons. And I was talking to an Israeli very recently who just said, you know, that can't happen. You know, somebody's got to stop them. And that's obviously a very difficult and a very volatile situation. Could precipitate very bad things.
Well, give me odds, though. Is it going to happen?
Odds, no. I think we will continue with brinksmanship. Push comes to shove. I think that they will back down. I think we will probably scream and shout at both Iran and Syria over supplying the forces in Iraq. But having said that, this gets back to the fundamental problem. The war that we're fighting is not the war that the other side is fighting. So when we I've got a new paper that'll be out shortly, a monograph for the Joint Special Ops University, and in it I address, or I say, the concept of the nation state, in fact, is failing. And, you know, we believe that countries are kind of the ultimate social organization in the world, and all our international laws are built up on that. And yet information technology now allows people to get together based on belief system. I mean, your program is a good example. It's going over, you know, all over. You don't even know who all the people are that are being influenced by the information that you put out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're going to find social groupings in the future along those lines that do not follow the lines of the old countries and nation states, as we assume. We call them rogue states, and they don't even necessarily have the capability of controlling the people, you know, who are inside them. And there are a lot of them that just shouldn't exist.
Well, then how do you know who to fight back, John? Going to be a problem in the future.
You hit the nail on the head. It is going to be, I think there are two major conflicts that we're headed for. One is going to be generally with Islam in general. The other is going to be with China, but it's not going to be a direct confrontation. I think the people who are worried about, you know, the Chinese taking Taiwan or something just don't understand what's going on. They're going to dominate the world economically, and they're moving to do that.
And it's for them. It's going in the right direction.
Oh, absolutely. I spent most of June in Tibet, and I kind of came away with a different view of Tibet than, you know, kind of the popular one that's put out certainly in the West. And the Chinese are just going gangbusters. Now, you cannot forgive, the way they, you know, subjugated Tibet in the 1950s. Having said that, they are dragging them out of the Middle Ages and the infrastructure going in. Where I think that is significant, you know, this is a pretty remote area. And yet, if you look at the road building that's going in, the railroads that are going in, and things of that nature, it says their focus is on economic infrastructure. They're not going to do anything, in my view. I think they'll posture, but they won't do anything to cause a direct military intervention with us because that would damage the infrastructure. And they're doing so damn well at it. You know, why would you screw things up,
mm-hmm.
let alone with the biggest trading partner? You know? And one of our strategic issues is the balance of trade agreements between us and China.
Of course, the big fight will be, John, over food and water one day, I think.
Don't think you're going to have to fight. I think they're going to dominate, you know, unless we wake up and we realize that, you know, the conflict is on and has been going on for some time, it won't get to actually fighting for it. You can win. In fact, this is a key issue in this new paper, is that in war, violence becomes optional. I think we'll still see people fight, you know, from time to time, but I don't think that will be the dominant factor that determines winning and losing.
You mean for the Chinese or for us?
For large groups, and I think this is the approach the Chinese are taking, although they are doing quite a lot to develop their military. There's no doubt about that. But if you look at the moves that they're making throughout the rest of the world in developing new trading partners, who is down in South America, for instance, tremendous alliances that are going there, and as close as Mexico and throughout the Caribbean. They're making tremendous inroads in Africa and some pretty good ones into Europe. It is, you know, we're just not paying attention to what's going on in that arena and looking at it as to whether or not what kind of level threat that presents to us. And the other side is, of course, you know, our balance of trade is just so out of whack.
It's gone. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But in the short term, you know, that's good because we get to buy cheap goods. Long term may not be so good.
Well, and China was successful because they have cheap labor and they're putting out a pretty respectable product.
They're good. I was amazed at what I saw.
Not like the old days when people used to make fun of some of the material that came out of China.
Oh, but remember you may be old enough. I certainly am. Remember the Made in Japan was a joke.
Yep.
And now, it's, you know, now Japan, interestingly, is outsourcing to China.
Yeah, yeah. Do you see us headed then toward either a one-world government or divisions within? Maybe we're not going to have countries anymore. I mean, the way things look like now, I think we're going to be one big North America. I don't think we're going to be just a single country anymore. I can see it. I can feel it. Don't you?
Very difficult to say. There's a very interesting book called Who Are We? Samuel Huntington from Harvard. And he points out to the problems of the United States in determining who we are. Now, we used to be, you know, pretty much WASP-dominated. I used to live in New Mexico, and what was unique about that, it was the only state that did not have a majority from, you know, a racial or ethnic population, and now several states are like that. And so what you see are tremendous demographic changes, and with that, some real differences in thoughts and beliefs. And so my notion is that the social structures of the future are based on belief systems, not on geography. So it doesn't matter where you were born. It has to do with, you know who your parents are, what your beliefs are. And that we run into problems when you have competing belief systems. And so this notion of national allegiance, I think, is going to be one that's very difficult to maintain.
I think you're right. And with that, then, comes these non-lethal weapons. Weather manipulation. I've got some people who've been on the program, and they are convinced that Hurricane Katrina was moved to hit those oil fields. One group thinks it's the Russians that did it. Another doesn't. Thinks it's the oil companies. What do you think? Do you think through non-lethal weaponry, they've played around with the weather, John, to the point where they can move hurricanes, push them where they want?
No, I think we just pissed off Mother Nature. I put this one down to pretty much, you know, a natural track. Now, I think the real danger, and this is very much natural science, is that there is sort of a groove that hurricanes get into. And they do tend to follow one after another. I was in Florida, you know, after the hurricanes last year, and that was just devastating. I do think we are looking at probably more global weather changes, but I don't think it's being engineered. I think it's just...
Can we engineer, though?
Very little, and not on the kind of scale that is being... projected. And again, you have to ask, you know, who does that and to what end?
Well, you know, we've got this huge array called HARP up there in Alaska.
Yep.
They got to be doing something with that. They're pulsing something.
Well, I think that's basically a communication system, and I understand that's not a popular view with a lot of folks, and particularly a number of yours, but I think it's pretty much straightforward research. There were, and in fact, in Winning the War, I have a chapter called Six Sigma Solutions, and these are kind of long-range things that we have to do if we're going to win the war. The first, as I mentioned earlier, is change the energy paradigm, but one of them is weather engineering. But there are huge dangers in that pretty much the technologies out there don't create weather. It's like a balloon, you know, you move stuff from one place to another. So if you get rain in one area, it means it doesn't rain someplace else. I do think what we're seeing now is more the global warming issues because of ineptitude of civilization. But
We are in a cycle. We're in an earth change cycle, and I don't think we can stop it. I think we're having a polar shift, and who knows what's going to happen when that, you know, goes full boat.
Yeah, there's no doubt that, well, I mentioned we were in Tibet. The snow line there was at 22,000 feet. There's been a number of articles about the glaciers melting, and we could see that. There was more water on the Tibetan plateau than I would have ever anticipated. Short term, that's good, grows a lot of crops. Long term is this stuff goes away, there's nothing left.
That's right.
And I was also in Antarctica beginning of the year, and you were beginning to see things there as well.
Well, unfortunately, John, you know, mankind has contributed to it, but I still think it's the planet doing what it does.
Well, hard to say, but as you know, with 6 billion people, and we used to joke about, you know, cow farts we're going to do in the world. But there actually is an awful lot of methane that is brought about because of humanity.
I want to ask you, but I want to get back to some of these pulse weapons and things. But would you give me, first of all, for people who want to understand this better, a definition of depleted uranium?
Well, it just means that the radioactive, now, this is not pulsed energy, you understand.
Right.
This is a very dense material. It is uranium that's no longer as, you know, a fissile material. In other words, you're not going to be able to put it into reactors because the electrons have come out of it. It is tremendously dense. The advantage to that is you can take relatively small bullets, like the 20 millimeter, and from a weapons perspective, you get a huge amount of kinetic energy. In other words, you can penetrate things very well. With the problem is that there is some radiation left, and it makes kind of a mess. So, as I said, the plus side is it can really tear up things like armored vehicles and that with relatively small weapons. The bad side is that we have determined, you know, after the fact to go in and kind of try to clean up the areas where the munitions have been used.
Well, now, it is a problem. I think we're using it in Iraq on a regular basis. What's going to happen to the citizenry with
I don't think we're using very much there. I think we did some initially when you're attacking large armored columns. Certainly not what folks are using on a regular basis. And again, we're back to the low-level radiation is not nearly as harmful as I think a lot of people make out.
If you were given the task of running our foreign policy, basically, right now, and they just said, John, just do whatever it takes, but let's just stop what's happening. Stop these wars. Stop the fighting. Or maybe you're going to recommend we go full boat. What would you do?
My problem is that I think we've made such a mess that I don't know how you get out of it.
With everything?
Yeah, kind of across the board. And this is why I mentioned before the thing that has to change at the strategic level is our energy policy and energy paradigm. And we cannot stay hooked to petrochemicals.
Do you see that happening? Do you see that happening?
Unfortunately, no.
No, either do
I. I see, you know, kind of fits and starts, but nothing that says on a national exigent basis, we're going to do this. You know, and I think that's what it takes. And I think we could. I think we know how to do those things. I just don't see us, again, the national leadership or will to do that. And as long as you keep that, for the near term, the Middle East becomes critical. And I don't think the Middle East is solvable. And particularly as long as, Israel continues to exist. I know some people say I'm advocating, you know, that Israel not exist. I'm not at all. I'm just saying I don't think realistically that you can solve that, or that you can solve the problem of Jerusalem in particular. So that remains, the whole area remains volatile for certainly the near future. And if that's where most of the oil resides that you can get at to, at, you know, relatively easily, we talk about doing the stuff in, you know, Northern Bank and Alaska and all that. Well, that's 10 years. And that's staying on the same technology. So,
isn't it interesting, though, how oil has just shot up the longer we're in Iraq? And yeah, I don't even think we've seen really the impact from Katrina yet, because they're getting some of those places back online.
Yeah. No, it. But I think the one thing it has done is awaken everybody to say, you know, hey, this is really serious. This is now affecting every person in the United States. It's not just those over there. Gas went up to, you know, remember when gas went to $1 or $1.50 a gallon, we thought it was atrocious.
It's all mind control, John. They're manipulating us. They get it up to past $3, and they've lowered it again down to like $2.80, and you think you're getting a deal.
Yeah. Such a deal I have, yeah.
That's what they're doing to us. And people, I don't think, have slowed down driving. I think people are driving their vehicles at the same rate that they were doing a year ago and a year before that.
You know, you really do need the SUV for those traffic bumps in the parking lots at the shopping center.
Or what about for the potholes?
Yeah.
Stay with us, John. We'll be back. Remote viewing, that's next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, don't forget, StreamLink members, those of you, we'll have our Tuesday night chat tomorrow, okay? 8 o'clock Pacific time at 10 o'clock Central time for you. It's 11 o'clock Eastern time. I'll be there for you, and we'll just chat for 1 hour. Last one we did a month ago was fun. So become a member, by the way, of StreamLink. There's much more than just looking to the show. You get all kinds of things, including podcasts now, where you simply download overnight, and the program's waiting for you on your pod. It's just a perfect way to listen to the program whenever you want at your convenience. And it's getting better and better and better. And when I get back to Los Angeles, it's webcam time, and we're going to be doing some more changing to the website as well. I got put back a little bit with some other projects, but we're ready to get rolling on that again. And by the way, now's time to say hello to all of you listening on your favorite radio stations across the world. Those of you, of course, who are StreamLink members, and then the various chat rooms that are set up. The people that love the program sit down at night with their friends at their computer, listening, chatting, reacting, commenting, and it's just a fun way for people to get involved. They include, of course, the StreamLink members that call themselves the Coast Riders. There's the Fantastic Forum Pirates. There's the new group that is the up-and-coming group called the NighthawkZone.com group. And Sorcery IRC, National Radio Club, that list keeps growing. But hi to all of you. Now, when we come right back, it's Colonel John Alexander and the rest of Non-Lethal Weaponry. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines for you so you have an opportunity to chat with John as well, as the program continues on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Colonel John Alexander, I guess. John, remote viewing. Well, tell me, what was your involvement with the military with that, if at all?
Well, actually, I was running some parallel stuff. I was familiar with the work that a number of your guests have done, from Joe McMonagle and Ed Dames and Paul Smith and I was actually working on psychokinesis. I might mention, you know, Ronson said that remote viewing was the only thing that worked. That was far from true. We had, you know, a number of these advanced technologies and neurolinguistic programming and PK that actually worked. And
Did it?
Yeah.
Such as? How did it work?
You probably know Uri Geller.
Uri.
Well, actually, there was a guy by the name of Jack Houck, who was an aerospace engineer at McDonnell Douglas at the time, and he had developed a process where we could take people and teach them in very short order how to do metal bending, and you've probably heard about the metal bending parties and that, really happened. problem was that not nearly as controlled. We didn't have a model for it as Ingo came up with for remote viewing. But sometimes you saw some pretty major events. If you want, I can give you a couple of examples.
Yeah, if I was just going to ask you for that. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, the most spectacular one that I ever saw, I was actually teaching how to do this. The whole process takes about an hour or two. So we're talking relatively short period. Naive people, in other words, people like you and I and a group of folks. Now, the groups I was working with were fairly senior military people and had a group at a sequestered site. And they were holding two forks in their hands. So both hands were occupied, no physical force whatsoever. And all of a sudden, this one fork just fell over 90 degrees. Without the individual touching it, he was holding it at the base, but, you know, no physical force applied, which I didn't see, but a number of people around him did, and they yelled, and then while we watched, the fork came back up, went back down again to about 90-degree level, and then partway back up and stopped, and just scared the hell out of the guy. He put it down and said, "I wish that hadn't happened," because his belief system was not ready for that. And I still have
totally shattered, wasn't it?
Yeah, and fortunately, we were sequestered and we had a shrink with us because it took a couple of days to put him back together before we could.
Really? He fell apart that much?
He was pretty shook. But that's the only time that I've actually seen something wave like that. I've seen them bend a number of times, small bending, full 90-degree bends. Again, totally without physical force. And, yeah, I know about Randy's, million-dollar quest and all this, and I've watched him do it, and I think I can catch him. I know most of the techniques. They also say, oh, you never had magicians. Well, yeah, I had Doug Henning. I don't know if you remember Doug. Doug had come over. And the thing that blew him away was we had a party for him at my house. And one of the first people to bend something was his manager. So he knew that we hadn't set him up because it was his guy.
I remember Henning. He's the one who used to smash the watermelons, wasn't he? Was that him? In his stage presentations?
Don't remember smashing.
I think it was. Yeah. Long hair, mustache?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was. I'm pretty sure that was him.
I've seen him jump on from one place to another, you know, the motorcycles and jump through the air and disappear. He later went on to do some work with Maharishi. And unfortunately got cancer and died way too early. But
very young age, absolutely. Well, this effect that you were all doing, what was the application? What did the military want with this?
Well, I used to get facetious comments like, what are you going to do, bend tank barrels? And I said, no, I just want to move electrons. And so my concern certainly was that you could influence computers. And you really don't have to crash computers, although there's a long history of, you know, people who are not computer friendly and they can't be around them and they crash. And we also know that they often crash when people are in emotional crisis and whatnot. And so the idea, you know, that I was concerned with is, as you know, we have entered the digital age. We were just coming into it in the early 80s. We're certainly there now. And you have this vast amount of computer technology embedded in everything. And if that ever became unstable, the implications are horrendous, of course.
Did you ever, when you were testing this entire field that you were in, did you ever feel as if you were dabbling in something that you shouldn't be?
No. Now, we used to run it. One of the arguments, and I think one of the things that did injure us in the long run, I had mentioned General Stubblebine earlier, who was one of our major supporters, and we did get into a bit of a conflict when General Wickham, was then the chief of staff of the Army, who was, you know, this devout Christian, and they would say things, you can do this, but it's the work of the devil. And my personal belief system says, no, we're dealing with physics, but a level of physics we just don't understand yet. But there certainly were people who would espouse those things. I think it's a matter of understanding. I think there are native peoples around the world who do these things routinely. The problem is that we just don't understand the principles yet.
Do you believe that when things happen, strange things, do you sometimes sit back and go, I wonder if there's a group practicing this or trying to do this? Do you ever think that, John?
No. I don't think there is, for some pretty good reasons. I do think there are things like synchronicity, and that there are forces that are greater than ourselves that tend to guide a number of things. But interfering, macro psychokinetic interference or things like that, guided by intention, I don't see it. Similarly, I don't see a black remote viewing program. You know, people say, well, yeah, it was killed in 95, but it was so good, it must have gone, you know, underground. And I don't find any evidence to support that. I think we should have continued the program.
Sure.
But I don't see evidence to support it. And I see the difference. I think there are people now who do individual efforts and input, and it's an old boy net, as opposed to when the program, you know, Stargate was running, there was a set procedure and ways to get it into the system, and so the information could be used or not used, as the case may be, as opposed to just trying to find somebody who will listen.
Well, I got to tell you, the entire field has always fascinated me. It's got some tremendous upside. It should have been continued. The fact that it wasn't tells you other things. And quite frankly, I don't think it went undercover, because if it did, it did so without all the good guys, people like you and Paul.
Exactly. Yeah, we all know each other. And in fact, General Stubblebine and I were just discussing this within the past few weeks, and because he said, well, maybe it went. And I said, but the talent pool is too small. Now, this was before, the folks went out and started teaching lots of others.
Sure, but I agree with you, because I don't think they were going to start all over again with new people.
It took too long to train the folks we had, and, you know, to get them into the system and clearances and da-da-da-da, just all of that, just not there. That doesn't mean that there aren't, because there are people inside the government today who have personal interest, and you can call them up and say, gee, you know, here's information. But the problem is there's a disconnect between that point and getting it into the system where it can be acted upon.
What do you think the possibilities are of other countries doing this now on a regular basis? China, Russia, who knows?
Yeah, I've got to guess they're doing it. I mean, I can't imagine that. And the question is, how much of a concerted effort? But I do think there are other folks with protocols that are certainly exploring the area, if not, you know, exploiting it.
Well, John, would you like to be back in the program?
Oh, sure.
How did you get involved?
Well, actually, the way I started was I wrote an article that's pretty well known by people in the field now called The New Mental Battlefield, which we talked about remote viewing and psychokinesis, and submitted it with absolutely no hope of it being published. And unbeknownst to me, on synchronicity, well, it turns out that the editor of the magazine, this was the Army magazine at Command General Staff College, had a near-death experience. So he had no doubt when I started talking about OBEs and remote viewing. You know, now what's the chance of that?
Exactly.
You know, but so he changed it from just an article and decided to publish it to the cover article. It made a little tiny blip when it first came out. And then Jack Anderson wrote some really nasty articles based on, it was, look what the foolish people in the Pentagon are doing. They're wasting your money.
Wasting money, yeah.
And so he did a series actually written by Ron McRae. And what happened was that the response from the public was overwhelming. And about 3 years later, the book came out. And by this time, it had switched from, look what the crazy people are doing, to, gee, this is kind of neat. You know, had this complete philosophical shift. Now, in the meantime, I had been giving some briefings, and so just sort of got swept up into it. And it was at a time when this Project Delta we mentioned earlier was, and we had a lot of flexibility, and we were looking at, you know, scanning the horizon for what is out there, and with the flexibility to play quite a bit, and using things like Jim Channon's First Earth Battalion as a mechanism to discuss these in a way that the military would understand it.
Well, how did you then evolve into non-lethal weaponry and an expert in that area? I mean, these are pretty drastic differences.
Yeah, and there's not a direct linkage. And this is, again, another area in the book that is totally inaccurate. This was actually a logical progression of as the world changed, and by now I had retired, and I was in my second career at Los Alamos National Laboratory. And we were looking initially at defeating the Soviet Union and trying to do so with the minimum amount of energy necessary. And the idea was, how do I disrupt their command and control systems and their logistics systems and those sorts of things? And over time, and then, of course, along came Just Fury and Panama, Just Cause, or Urgent Fury, Just Cause, a whole series of operations. And again, looking at that, I just said, you know, overwhelming force doesn't work. You know, we got to have something else. And so because I was in the scientific institution, being able to go out and talk to people and say, what kind of technologies have we got where we can apply force without killing people? It became obvious that killing people, you know, is in general long-term detrimental. And by the way, I do think there are some people who deserve to be dead. So I don't want to be seen totally as a pacifist here. But having said that, like I say, you really want to be very discriminate and, you know, minimize casualties if at all possible. And that led to sort of developing this whole penumbra of non-lethal weaponry, which, you know, runs a very broad spectrum.
Did you or anybody within this group ever attempt to, like, kill someone in the Soviet Union with mind power?
No.
Was that ever attempted?
No. No, not at all.
Could it work? What happens if everyone concentrated, let's say, on, at the time, Khrushchev, let's say,
yeah,
or something like that? Khrushchev, of course,
well,
before
the
you
thing
brought
that concerned
it
me in those years was that the only country with the capability of getting enough people together to concentrate on a single issue at one time was probably China. You know, where they could get, if you had 100 million people, that's now less than 10% of their population. And because of the centralized system where you could go out and, you know, one of the problems that China's had over time is they've had a number of programs like birds got to be a problem, so they went out and had a day where everybody kills birds. Well, they did that, and guess what? Insects grew. So this tendency to overdo things because of concentrated effort. And quite frankly, we knew from Hal Puthoff and some of those folks who had been involved with the Chinese and seen some very, very interesting research that had been done there, that they certainly had the basic capabilities to do that. So that was an area of concern. But it still takes a lot of training and a lot of – one of the things that I don't think, you know, the remote viewers themselves talk about is, you know, it takes a lot of effort.
Oh, yeah. It's not easy.
You don't just go, say, gee, I think I'll read a book and go do this. You know,
it
takes a lot of work.
Got to get into the groove before it happens.
And Americans are into the instant gratification. You know,
I tried that
for 15 minutes, didn't work, it must not work at all, you know.
Yeah, I'm bored, I have to go on to something else.
Right.
Hey, by the way, it was not Doug Henning who smashed watermelons, it was Gallagher, the magician. Right. Remember that?
Yeah.
He would do his thing.
I thought he was more of a
comic type.
Comic, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, stay with us. You ready one more hour, John, with phone calls?
We can handle that.
Colonel John Alexander, next on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Your phone calls, Colonel John Alexander, our guest. Colonel, I've gotten a couple email responses from John Ronson in regards to your comments. Can I read a few? You want to react to a couple of them?
Sure.
Okay, let's see what he's got here, because an email just came in. Good thing. He says, one of the things, to the best of my knowledge, I've never met John Ronson. He says, I certainly did meet Colonel Alexander. I spent a half a day interviewing him on film at his house. What is true is that when I wanted to ask Colonel Alexander some supplementary questions after my first interview, he told my producer he was heading off to Afghanistan in 4 months. So that's
not true.
That one.
The person who was here was John Sargent.
Ah, okay.
That's what he said. This John Sargent.
Who was the producer, I guess.
Well, he says he's the producer. Now, John is the one who had set it up, came and did the filming, and I did the interaction with.
Unless he's changing his name.
Well, that's why I said when this first came up, I asked Simon & Schuster specifically if John Ronson and John Sargent were the same person. And they emphatically said no. I later saw pictures, and it's certainly not the same person.
Okay.
In the book, he does credit. In fact, in his credits, he says, John Sargent is found on almost every page of this book.
All right. With regards to you saying I was portrayed as a fabled goat steer in the book, John says, no, he wasn't. I was making reference to Guy Savelli, fabled as the fabled goat steer. So it goes on and on. Maybe we'll get you two together one day rather than for me to read all this.
That. That's actually in the issue in Playboy, and that is a direct quote. It says, fabled goat starer John Alexander.
Well, that's true. Now, John.
Let me read it. This is, and this is an article written by Ronson. Says, I couldn't forget, and I finally, after months of searching, I managed to track down fabled goat starer, a Colonel John Alexander, who is among Al Gore's oldest friends.
Okay.
That's a quote from Playboy.
Okay. And by the way, Ronson has a very distinctive British accent. If that sergeant guy had one.
Oh, he's from the U.K. Sargent was from the U.K.
Oh, he was too. Okay.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, no, this was...
All right. Yeah, maybe we'll get you both together one day. Let's go to the calls. People are waiting.
Okay.
You ready? First-time caller line, you're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yes, my name is Priscilla.
Hi, Priscilla. Go
ahead. Hi. George, I recently wrote to you. I am a new fan of your program, and I really enjoyed it. I have missed intellectual discussions that I used to enjoy in college.
Well, we're glad you're here. Go ahead, Priscilla.
Thank you. My question for the Colonel, are you familiar with domestic terrorism involving the use of electromagnetic weaponry and remote viewing, which includes microwave torture?
I don't know. I mean, that's sort of like, have you heard of, I'm sorry, that's just way, way too broad. What is the question?
Okay, you should be familiar with electromagnetic weaponry, is that correct?
Oh, yes.
Can you elaborate on how that is used?
You sure can, and I'll let you listen on your radio. Go ahead, John.
The answer is rarely. There is a new system that has been developed. We talked about earlier the active denial system. There's now a smaller version called Sheriff, which is it's a beam weapon that's put out to that cause pain. It hits the skin and interacts and causes a lot of pain, and you want to move out of the beam very quickly. Having said that, I was concerned about where they're going. There's also a huge mythology about microwave weapons and, you know, mind control and that sort of things. And I get a lot of emails from individuals who, you know, say they're being, you know, attacked by either them or the government or mm-hmm. that. It's a huge conspiracy issue. And I do not put much stock in that.
Would you be surprised if it was going on?
Enormously. Yeah.
East of the Rockies, you're up now with Colonel Alexander. Hi there.
Hi, good morning, George and Colonel Alexander. A wonderful show, George.
Thank you, sir.
The most potentially advantageous but very dangerous development, in my view, is the advent of nanofabricated, microfabricated neural computers that are embedded within one's very neural physiology, massive parallel array with artificial intelligence for instant wisdom and knowledge. But I suggest that would pose a threat to somebody, and so they would want to have, let's put it this way, a fatal safeguard built in should the individual become more accomplished than most of our statespersons. I put to you that that kind of application could undermine various intelligences within the world community, but it also could prove a boon should they get the right person and do the right thing with that technology. What kind of information do you have on that kind of development?
Well, it's been made into a number of movies, of course, and I think that's where most of it is. It's certainly far from reality, and particularly when you get into the aspect of we're going to boost intelligence with it. I think there's some tremendous advances, and I understand, George, you're going to have somebody on addressing nanotechnology in the future.
Tomorrow, yeah.
Some really huge advances coming in the field. I don't think it's going to be boosting intelligence or anything approaching that yet.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate you being part of the program.
I think the idea, though, of being able to inject a surgeon is really pretty neat, you know, for people with problems with blood where you want to be able to go in and they'll put in little boring machines and things like that. Just a number of really neat advances on the immediate horizon.
Yeah, I guess what bothers me, John, is what we talked about when we first started, how some of our involvement as a nation, some of it gets screwed up. It just seems like the old days, you know, during World War II and in other episodes like that, where it seemed like whatever we did, we finally clicked on all cylinders. We're not doing that now. Why has that changed?
Well, I'm not sure it has changed. I think the speed with which technology advances certainly has changed. And in the past, I mean, you go back World War II, we're talking, you know, 50, 60 years. Technology was coming along relatively quickly, but in general, you had a period to adjust to new technology. So the protocols, ethics, laws, and all of that had a chance to come along. Now, the change in information technology, nanotechnology, biology, for the things that are advancing so quickly that society does not have time to adjust and accommodate all of those changes. I mean, look what's happened in broadcast industry, you know, digital technology, and everything is going on with, you know, copyright infringement and what you can do to copy things off, just as an example, and yet we're actually making laws as we go along. So I think that's the issue, is that society just doesn't have the time to adjust to the changes that are taking place. So we pretty much make up things as we go, and it leads to a certain degree of chaos.
Well, that's true, too. I mean, even in broadcasting, they're experimenting now with digital voices to do intros, let's say, in the music packages. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like there's a real human being there, but he's a computer. I've been accused of being a computer myself, John, by the way.
Well, I actually, again, in Winning the War, I addressed that. And, in fact, there was a movie out a year or so ago where, they invented a person. And I think it's not far on the too far horizon that you will be able to select the reporter that you want to hear, who will be, computer-generated, and they will deliver the news in the way that you see fit.
Were they, in addition to the remote viewing and the PK, were they ever working on any time machine devices during your days?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go
to
our...
I think it'd be neat, but...
Oh, be fantastic.
I don't know how to do that.
Yeah. West of the Rockies.
Bill Corso did mention that. I will say that.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
He did.
Yeah.
Hello, West of the Rockies. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, this is Dennis from Salt Lake City.
Hi, Dennis. Welcome. Go ahead.
I got a couple questions. Basically, I bought the Tegra remote viewing deal from Ed Dames a few years back, and I went through the first couple tapes, and then I did a little session, and I nailed right on the head what it was, and I haven't touched it since. And it didn't, I don't know if it didn't really scare me, it just, I don't know why I haven't had the desire to even look at it anymore, to try it.
Maybe you just want to retire with 100% accuracy, huh?
I've never been 100% in my life on anything, but it's just kind of odd, because I was really psyched to do it.
Well, there are a lot of people who just want to see for themselves, can you do it, and then say, that's okay.
Well, I just...
Well, where do you go?
All right.
Lost him right at the end.
Right.
But
there are people who just want to taste and then say, okay, we can do that, enough of that, and then go on to something else. So.
Did you know Corso at all, Philip Corso?
I knew Phil quite well.
Oh, my
goodness. And, in fact, I had been with him a week before he died. I saw him between heart attacks. And it turned out I had been down in Florida for my son's wedding, and he lived up at Fort Pierce. So we went up and spent a day with him, and... He was getting ready to do another book. And,
yes, that's true. That's true.
Phil couldn't write and certainly was not computer literate. And so everything he had written out by hand. So there were stacks and stacks of stuff to go through. So we had quite a stuff. I think he was a neat guy. I disagree with some of his findings, but I just really liked him personally.
Did you find him to be honest?
Oh, I think so. We just disagreed on, there's a true conundrum there. And I had spent substantial time with him on a number of occasions and then had spent quite a bit of time, I spent a week back in Washington verifying his background. And some of it fit very well and there were some very unique things. But having said that, most of the technological issues that he raised just did not track.
Did you know him when he was in the military or after the fact?
No.
Just after the fact.
Yeah, he was considerably older than I. And at the time that he was still in, I was a young sergeant.
Well, let's look at this for just a moment, John, because the case of Philip Corso fascinates me. I mean, here you have a person who was so high up in the military, so honored, so respected, saying these just incredible things about Roswell and about crashed saucers and aliens and reverse engineering. Do you think he was wrong on all of it, or... Some of it?
Certainly some. And one of the things that Phil told me, again, just before he died, was that he needed to do, the reason for doing the second book was so that he could correct errors from the day after Roswell. And I had written him an extensive letter going kind of line by line and saying, this is wrong. And I'll give you a macro example. The book alludes to that world. The Cold War was a cover to get ready to fight the aliens. And I'm going, no, it was because we were opposed by the Soviets. And I used, I pointed out that, are you familiar with Desert Storm?
Yes.
And the Iraqis, and this was the 1991 war, the Iraqis at that time had very, very sophisticated air defense systems. And our technological leap was about 10 years, and we brought that system to its knees in minutes. Okay? And that's with a 10-year leap. Now, I cannot believe there's any Earth technology if we believe that, you know, the ETH, the extraterrestrial hypothesis, that these terribly advanced aliens are out there and they're coming here, that somehow our weaponry is going to be pose, you know, any significant threat to them. It just doesn't make sense.
But he couldn't have been wrong about it all. And, you know, something happened there at Roswell.
I've always posited that Roswell is a conundrum, and you're right, something happened. I just have never been able to sort it out, and I've looked at it from a lot of different angles and talked to many of the key people involved, and it is a puzzlement.
See, the part, of course, so the day after Roswell, and I know his co-author, Bill Burns, he's working on a project with me. He's very meticulous. So some of the things that Corso must have told him must have just shocked Burns, quite frankly.
Yeah, but, and I've talked to Bill about it as well. And there was a huge discrepancy between when Phil said, I didn't have a chance to review the book before it went out. And Bill says, no, we went over it page by page. And I went to a third author, whom you may know, the guy who wrote The Green River Killer.
Yes.
With him.
Yes, and Bill knows him real well as well.
And, yes, and he just said, you know, hey, when he and Bill had worked together, I mean, they went line by line for approval. And so I just don't know what to make. I mean, you hear credible stories from both sides, and it you know, you end up not knowing, you know, which to believe. But I can say, let me give you one, if we have time, a specific.
I've got a minute. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, this is the night vision equipment, for instance.
Right.
Knew the guy who developed night vision lab, built the lab and all that, followed the technology, knew him well enough to even bring up strange things to him. And there just are no, you know, there are no big leaps in technology. We can follow it straight through. The money issue, he said he went down with $5 million. And it was somebody else who delivered the money, and that's pretty well documented. So there were pieces of it that just, you know, just don't make sense. And I never have figured it out.
It's got to be baffling.
It is.
To everybody. Okay.
And again, nice guy. I really liked him.
Stay with us. Colonel John Alexander is our guest. John, by the way, the book, Winning the War, is that still out there?
Oh, yes. That's the most recent one.
And you can get that?
I think you've got a hyperlink to it. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we sure do.
Through Amazon.
Absolutely. Okay, stay with us. We'll wrap it up with the rest of your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're going to take this final half hour right up to the top, and we'll take phone calls with our guest, Colonel John Alexander, in a moment. On Coast to Coast AM. Well, John, let me ask you, do you believe in the existence of extraterrestrials out there?
Tough question.
Oh, really? Why?
Well, it's an area I've played with for a long, long time. I don't think the ETH, or the extraterrestrial hypothesis, answers all of the questions. Now, my notion is that, the probability that intelligent life is out there, I think the odds are overwhelmingly in favor of that. But then when you get down to visiting and whatnot, I happen to also, on the other side of the coin, say I think assuredly UFOs are real. I think the physical evidence supporting that is absolutely overwhelming. You know, where do they come from, I think, gets to be a very tricky and a complex question.
I mean, they could be dimensional. They could be coming from other planets. They could be coming from within our own planet.
Right. I mean, there's just the number of possibilities. That's why people tend to jump to what's known colloquially as the ETH, or extraterrestrial hypothesis. If they don't come from here, they must come from someplace else. I think that the universe is built much more complex than we understand, and it's not. I don't think it's either or.
You knew Ingo Swann, right?
Oh, I know him. Yeah.
And he, you know, good guy.
Oh yeah.
He might get on the program. What do you think of his remote viewing on the backside of the moon? I mean, that's pretty startling stuff too. I mean, see, these guys, you know these people,
yeah,
like Corso.
Ingo's a personal friend. Love him. He's an interesting curmudgeon.
Father, they say, of remote viewing. You agree with that title?
Yes. Oh, okay. He played a pivotal role in the understanding of development of the matrix, and so you could make it a teachable skill. Having said that, frankly, I've seen the master be wrong. I really don't want to get into a peeing contest or something. But
do you think he has a vivid imagination?
Well, certainly that. But he has done some spectacular hits too. Now, some of the folks in the community get upset when I say, I think that, sometimes it works, and there are people who want to put this out that, hey, we've got, in the high 90% probabilities and all of that. I just don't buy into that. They certainly at times have been proven to be extremely accurate, and I think it's a very useful tool and one that's underutilized. I've read Ingo's stuff, and we've had discussions on it, and
do you think he's off base when he talks about structures on the backside of the moon?
But I also know people who went there, and they didn't find them.
Well, they didn't go to that side, though, right?
Oh, but there were people circling. Remember,
sure.
We pretty well circled it. So if there was any major bases on the back, yeah, we would have found them.
So you're saying this is possibly an Ingo Swann remote viewing aspect that didn't work?
Don't know if it worked or not.
Am I putting you on the spot on this one?
Yeah.
I'm giving
like
you
a... Ingo's a friend. I think he's a great guy. And let's just say there are places where we agree to disagree.
By the time you're off this show tonight, John, we would have destroyed all your friends.
No, I don't think so.
All right.
I mean, have these, very frank discussions among ourselves. And I do have problems. I mean, I told folks this, that make these outrageous claims that you see with some of the ads. And some of them have been your guests and are my friends, and, yeah, we debate it. So,
all right, onward we go. Let's go to our wild card line. Where are you calling from? Who are you?
George from Pittsburgh.
Oh, hello. George, go ahead.
And the Colonel, of course, a young fellow, the Philadelphia experiment, I saw the news many years ago, and then run into a PhD that actually worked on that project as far as the radar, and then it goes up to Montauk, and is related to what you've been talking about this millimeter bending. At Montauk, and I know in the Patton area, there's mine caps that seem to be able to transfer what I'll call orthogonal energy, and then they reverse it somehow that actually supposedly does projection in time. Do you have any knowledge or anything where the recording of this mindset that you can transfer it to another person to bend the so-called spoon, and it's kind of relative?
I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm sorry.
Do you divine, use metal rods and pendulums and that? Have you ever done that yourself on a personal basis?
I think you're talking about a couple of things. Now, you're talking about dowsing. Yeah,
I've
seen that and done that, and know lots and lots of people familiar with Seaborg Harvelick, who had done some really interesting work for the military, particularly in the during the Vietnam era, where they were interested in using it and finding caches and that sort of thing. So,
well, the dowsing with the coat hangers, if you have that experience, my own personal experience is that. Well, I can do it individually, but my one hand can also, with another individual, cause it to happen at a distance, which would be kind of relative to what you're
trying. Oh, no. The remote dowsing is done by a number of folks. In fact, Uri Geller uses some of those techniques. One of the things he does now is finding rare minerals for companies that are interested in exploration. and they do most of that remotely.
We've got a guest on, Ramon Grace, who also does this, you know, especially with the pendulum. It's almost like truth serum. Let's go to our first-time caller line. Where are you calling from? Hi there.
Good morning, George.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is also George. I'm calling from Princeton, Indiana.
Another George. Two in a row. That's odd. Go ahead.
Yeah, I thought you'd get a kick out of that. Listen, I've been listening for a couple years now, and I got to tell you, this is great stuff tonight. I've been just glued to the radio. I have a question for your colonel. I am also a retired Army first sergeant, and I spent several years in the TRADOC doctrine world, which I'm sure he's familiar with.
Oh, yeah. Going down to the Mad Scientist Conference in November.
Are you now?
At TRADOC, yep.
I've spent a few days at those myself. Listen, I worked on doctrine for several years, and specifically in the non-lethal realm.
Okay.
At least at the tactical level anyway.
Mm-hmm.
As I was retiring from the Army, there was a terminology shift away from non-lethal to less than lethal. And I know in the grand context of the discussion tonight, this is a pretty simplistic question, but... can you tell me, is there any significant difference between, you know, non-lethal and less than lethal, or is it just the TRADOC semantics game?
It's not a TRADOC semantics game. It's a semantics. It is one of the first questions that comes up in every discussion, every study, and whatnot. As to what's non-lethal and less, the law enforcement tends to use less lethal or less than lethal as their official terms, and justice picked up on that. From a technical perspective, no, there's not really any difference. We went round and round and round on this. I'm not sure what the best word is. At one point, forget who, maybe it was Cohen, but the secretary finally, Secretary of Defense stepped in and just said, you know, it will be, you know, non-lethal just to end the arguments because the first question that always comes up is there anything that's totally non-lethal? And the answer to that is no. My cute phrase is enough marshmallows properly placed will kill you. So, you know, there's nothing out there that won't kill anybody under any set of circumstances.
What do we need non-lethal? Why don't we just get them all, John?
Not a bad idea in some cases. And the bottom line is it doesn't work, and because it get them all. We can't identify them. That's the key
true.
Factor.
That's the whole thing right there. Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Pete.
Hi,
George.
Pete. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, I had a question for the colonel. I read a report that I guess had to do with the fact the U.S. government was planning to build a blimp or a dirigible to fly over the West Coast and Capitol to track the incoming and outgoing traffic as a means to help the fight against drugs and Homeland Security.
Right.
But as it had to do with Iraq, it said that our investment in the war was so significant that we were no doubt capable of assigning the resources properly to monitor the people responsible for killing, the most killing in Iraq, the car bombs, and that they could place as many blimps or dirigibles as needed to cover the entire area of concern, and then technicians, I guess, could backtrack from the car explosion to the point of origin, let's say a house or warehouse, and then they could go back and take care of them.
Is that doable? From a technical perspective, yes. From a practical perspective, it gets extremely difficult. And the problem is that, of course, any look-down system, be they satellites or UAVs or whatnot, can't see inside of buildings. So these things can be constructed inside. And, of course, you don't know that it's, you know, a car bomb until it goes off. And, of course, there's heavy traffic and whatnot.
Well, so, like in England, that's how they got those guys, is they played the tape back.
Sure, but remember that, of course, that was in the subway systems that are heavily monitored to begin with. And it's exactly what we're saying. You know, if you put enough time and effort into it, can you do that? The answer is yes. Will they find a way around it? Yeah, probably. You know, the problem, I don't know, we used to call them mines, but they now call them, you know, improvised explosive devices. which are just things that are scattered about and remotely detonated. And that's a move, counter-move sort of approach. You know, every time we get more sophisticated, they find a way around it. And the downside usually is that our moves, our technological approaches, are very expensive. The counter moves are very cheap.
Well, you know, John, also, weren't those bombers in London caught when their families started calling police saying, where's my son? Where's my relative? And I think that helped tip them off.
Well,
there were lots of
things that went together. But the biggest issue was, of course, that, you know, the whole area was so heavily monitored that, you know, once they started figuring out who to look for, it was easy to put the puzzle together, but it was certainly within the realm of doability. Now, by the way, I think that the horrendous issue here in the U.S. is, you know, how much monitoring are you prepared to tolerate? You know, my statement is that the future is pain-mediated, that the more pain we have, the more restrictions on civil liberties we're willing to tolerate. And right now it's moderately high, but not super high. But a few more bombings, and we'll be demanding infringement. And I live here in Las Vegas, and you know everything's monitored here.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
any place you go, you're on camera.
When are you going to run out of water there? By the way.
Don't know. It's the population growth is certainly going up. The good news this year, we were in extreme drought, and we did get a considerable amount of rain above average. But it would take a number of years to do that before we get back up to get the lake back where it needs to be. But
are they slowing down building also?
No.
Finally?
No.
They're not?
No. It's going gangbusters.
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on the air with John Alexander on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is John in Lakewood.
Hello, John. Go ahead.
Nice show. Thanks for taking my call. Unfortunately, I have to take exception here. Mr. Alexander, Dr. Colonel, whatever, is way too intelligent to have sold us some of the things he's been selling us. He's explained away the nation state, remote viewing, depleted uranium, weather control, to name a few. And I think that he is a consummate insider here to explain to us.
You think he's a disinformation agent?
No. He's a very intelligent man. I'm not picking on him. He's doing his job, okay? But the nation state isn't quite obsolete. Remote viewing works. Depleted uranium is very dangerous. And weather control, what of the weather control, the Air Force document controlling the weather by 2025? What of Mr. Bearden's work?
Yeah, let me address that document in particular, because that was a highly speculative paper, and that's one that's been quoted quite frequently as proof that the government involvement, when in fact what you had is a few guys writing, and in fact, like I said, in Winning the War, I wrote, to the same issue and quoted that document.
Right, war games and scenarios.
But there's a big difference between somebody speculating as to what could be done or should be done and a huge program to do that.
There sure is. Now, how do you account for the Soviet woodpecker grid, Tom Bearden's observations, Jim McCanny and company and his competition's observations, as regards real weather control really happening right now?
I don't see that. Now, you've asked several questions.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
The woodpecker signal was certainly out there. A lot of people spent considerable amount of time and effort looking at that. And I'm not sure anybody's ever come up with a satisfactory answer.
But there must be.
Tom tends to
somebody extrapolate. They wouldn't have done that much trouble, yes?
Yeah. But okay. Tom tends to extrapolate a considerable amount. In fact, I was addressing some things today, based on, his work, and I've known Tom for decades as well. But people seem to forget that some of the things that he explained early on, for instance, Legionnaire's disease was part of scalar wave technology. The Thresher was sank by it. In his I'm trying to think of it was the Excalibur briefing. He came out. He had the three-day war where the then Soviet Union was going to just destroy us and China in 3 days. None of those things have happened. So a very interesting, bright, innovative guy, but the stuff hasn't held up. I have not seen any evidence of major weather control programs, although, like I said, I think it is right. This is a very dangerous field.
There is a bill in Congress, though, John, a true bill that basically allows for weather manipulation. It's pretty elaborate. I can't recite the whole thing.
And there are international conventions against that. If you want to do something as simple as cloud seeding, there's a very detailed plans that you have to issue through NOAA. And there's a guy, I've lost the name here, who was doing some very interesting work. Using orgone energy. Now that's highly speculative.
That was William Reich.
This was somebody who picked up on.
He's dead.
Reich was the basic inventor. This was Trevor James Constable is who I'm trying to think of, who had picked up and done some work. And I saw some videotape of things that he was doing, truly spectacular on a micro scale, but actually, you know, manipulating clouds and causing it to happen. Don't see evidence, and I think James DeMeo now up in Washington has continued on with some of their work. But again, that's very different from a government program or engineering things like hurricanes that people are talking to.
John, we're out of time. Thank you again. Your website linked up with coasttocoastam.com through your book, Winning the War. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Dan Heiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.